Good afternoon. This is Gary from Chorus Call. Welcome to Seafarers Shareholder Conference Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. Seafarer will begin today's call with a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. A link to the presentation is available at the Seafarer website, seafarerfunds.com, and also in the reminder email you received today with the conference call details. I will now turn the conference over to Andrew Foster, Chief Investment Officer at Seafarer. Andrew, please go ahead.
Thanks, Gary, and good afternoon to everyone. Welcome to the firm's fifth semi-annual shareholder call. It's a little bit surprising to me to think we've already done five of these things, and our first call was scheduled directly opposite Gundlach and Double Line when that firm was really getting off the ground, and I'm not sure we had great participation there. So I'm very thankful that we were not scheduled directly opposite the USA game today, which we are so happy we've at least made it into the knockout round. I have not put 100% of the fund into Portugal, so don't worry about that. Anyway, on the call with me today are three of my colleagues, Kate Jaguet, Paul Espinoza, and Michelle Foster. Today's call is going to run a little bit longer than usual. Typically, we try to keep the presentation to about 45 minutes and allot 15 minutes for question and answers at the end. However, today, we have a bit more content than usual, so our presentation and formal remarks are likely to last roughly 55 to 60 minutes. We understand that some of you may need to drop off the call after an hour, but for those of you who can stay on, Michelle will lead a Q&A session at the end that will last about 15 minutes. As Gary mentioned, the presentation for today's call is available at our website, seafarerfunds.com. There you can also submit a question to us. Please note, we're going to give priority to those questions that were submitted in advance of today's calls, though we will receive your questions real time during the call, and we'll try to address them if we can. With these introductions out of the way, let's get started by turning to the next page in the presentation, page one. You'll note there are certain required fund and regulatory disclosures, and I'd have you read them at your own convenience. I also want to remind you that while we will discuss specific fund holdings on the call, these do not constitute an investment recommendation for you, as they may not be suitable for your individual portfolio. So let's move on to page two, where you can see the agenda for today's call. It's broken up into four sections. The first is a retrospective on the fund and also on Seafarer Capital Partners. The second is on China and what I'm referring to as the Great Wall of Worry. The third section is a cross-section of the Seafarer Fund in which we will present some analysis on the fund's construction and discuss some of the individual holdings within. And lastly, we'll wrap up with the Q&A section that I mentioned earlier. So to get the presentation underway, please turn to page three, where you will see a chart with a line that depicts the net asset value of the fund from inception through yesterday. You'll see also that a portion of it is in dark blue, and that represents the fund's movements since our last shareholder call in December. Yesterday, the fund paid a distribution of 7.5 cents per unit and finished at 11.73 per share on the institutional class. As you can see, from the time of our last call in December, there's been a lot of volatility in the markets, especially prompted by some wobbles in the and volatility in currencies in the emerging world that hit both the markets and the fund in December and January. But I am very pleased to report that the fund and the markets both have recovered their lost ground since that time, at least as of yesterday. In the interim period, we've been very busy here at Seafarer Capital Partners, and there have been a number of major events at the advisor that I'd like to discuss. First and foremost is the expansion of our team. Today with me on the call, we have a new member of the team, Paul Espinoza. I'd like to introduce Paul now.
Thank you, Andrew. Good afternoon, everyone. I have 16 years of investment experience in emerging markets, working at Legg Mason, Citigroup Asset Management, and JP Morgan Investment. I have focused mostly on consumer, industrial, and real estate sectors, but Andrew has asked me to act as a generalist at Seafarer, and I'm very happy to be here.
And we have been extremely pleased with Paul's arrival. I think he's added further depth to our team, and he's been a great contribution to our research efforts already, even though he's been here just shy of 2 months. Another milestone that I would like to report is that around the middle of May, the fund crossed the $75 million threshold in terms of its size. And that's been an important milestone for us because it's given us the confidence, witnessing that growth, witnessing the new clients coming in the fund, it's given us the confidence to again reduce expenses on the fund via a new contractual cap. What we're doing is that there are two share classes on the fund, an investor class and an institutional class. And prior to this cap, those classes were priced at 1.40% on the investor class, 1.25% on the institutional class. We will be recapping those expenses lower as of September 1st to 1.25% and 1.05% respectively. This is the second such fee reduction since the fund's launch, and we're really proud to pass this reduction on to shareholders. We, of course, are focused on performance first and foremost here, but we think one of our central missions is also to reduce expenses for shareholders with scale and with time. So moving on to page 4, you'll see a table that delineates the fund's performance since inception through the end of May, and I'm going to introduce Kate Jaquit to discuss it now.
Since the fund's launch on February 15th of 2012 and through May 31st of this year, the fund gained 24.5% for the investor class and 24.8% for the institutional class, while its benchmark, the MSCI Emerging Markets Total Return Index, rose 3.7%. By way of broader comparison, the S&P 500 index rose 50.5% over the same time period. Over the past year, the fund has returned 4.06% for the institutional class versus a 4.61% increase on the benchmark index.
It's been a rocky year in the emerging markets, and frankly, we've been hit by a number of negative macro events, including the Fed's tapering announcement, rolling mini currency panics. The fixed income markets in the emerging world until very recently have really been struggling, China's slowing growth, and quite a bit of political unrest spanning Ukraine to Thailand to Brazil. So it's been a tricky year, and what's really remarkable to me is how both the fund and especially the markets in the background have held up reasonably well, haven't lost a lot of value. Admittedly, they haven't kept up with the U.S. by any margin, but I think this speaks to the fact that markets are, in the emerging world, are at least inexpensive and capable of digesting a lot of bad news, this is a topic that I reflect on our recently released shareholder letter, which you can pick up on our website, and it will be published in an upcoming annual report shortly. This volatility has really been interesting for us here because I think it's given us opportunities to take advantage of some of the price declines in both stocks and also to get more comfortable with some of the currencies in the emerging world, which we thought were a bit toppy and potentially overvalued or risky when we first launched. And in practice, what that's meant is this fund over the past year has built a larger exposure to Brazil, where we have found a number of holdings that we're excited about but were a bit too expensive for us to enter when we first launched. And also, more recently, we've accumulated a small position in a basket of foreign currency-denominated sovereign bonds with higher yields, and we think those will be attractive for the yield-seeking component of the portfolio. So those are some of the shifts that have taken place that have really been thrown up by or are presented to us via this volatility. If we move on to page 5, you'll see another table that is largely redundant to the prior one, but we have to present it here for regulatory purposes. So let's move on to page 6 and discuss the Great Wall of Worry that is currently impeding China. For those of you unfamiliar with the term, a wall of worry is effectively a situation in financial markets where investors are, in aggregate, harboring a number of major big-picture worries regarding a particular segment of the equity market. However, against that perception, the underlying stocks in the market often grind steadily forward simply because the micro fundamentals slowly but ultimately outweigh the macro sentiment. and when this occurs, stocks are said to climb a wall of worry. I think this is a good analogy for what's taking place in China at the moment, because there are real and material and macro concerns certainly hanging over the market, and I don't wish to dismiss them. I share many of those worries. But I also think there are big gaps in perception based on what I hear clients talking about and based on what I read in the media. And I think China's future is unlikely to be as bad as is imagined, broadly speaking. And so I think there are gaps in perception between the fears and the reality. And thus, I intend for us together to examine the wall of worry carefully, separating fact from vague and possibly overstated or misplaced worry. And before we get started, Kate and I have just come back from a trip in China, and I would say that our findings from that trip were mixed, but were mildly more positive having done so. So while we're going to discuss some of China's more difficult aspects of its economy in the ensuing slides, I want you to remember at the end of the day, we're mildly more positive than we were 6 months ago. So let's move on to page 7, where you'll see a summary of what I call the major bricks in the wall of worry. What I've tried to do is list the four major concerns that are currently impeding people's perception of China and the underlying stock market there. I realize this is in really small font. We've had to do a lot to try and summarize things here, but the third column tries to spell out what people are really worried about. And the fourth column tries to spell out what Seafarer really thinks will happen, and therefore to spell out some of the gaps between what we think will be the reality and the perception. The four major bricks are as follows. The regulated banking system is in the first row, and people are really worried about it because it's large and state-controlled, and historically and presently, it's been a poor allocator of capital, and consequently, people are concerned that a large portion of its lending will go bad and cause financial disruption. I will tell you that I am worried about the same, but after our trip in which we visited a number of big banks, I'll tell you that I think non-performing loans are going to rise quickly, but the problem is ultimately manageable and being managed by the large state-controlled banks. And meanwhile, most of these larger banks have adequate capital to act as a buffer to the non-performing loans that are likely to come due. Meanwhile, several of the banks are already poised to raise additional capital to act as an additional buffer. So I think the banks largely are on top of the situation, even as it's prone to get worse. But ultimately, I'll tell you that the banks are too big and too connected to fail. And so I don't have great concerns that the core Chinese banking system is going to come under severe stress. I do think credit growth is going to decelerate, and that has follow-on effects that we'll discuss in a moment. The second row in the wall of worry is on the shadow banking system. And again, for those of you unfamiliar with the term, it's a very loose term, frankly, a very vague one, but the most common used definition is a system for allocating credit or capital that lies outside of a normal regulated banking system. Usually that system has less regulation, less oversight, and less capital backing it, and therefore most folks rightly worry it tends to engage in riskier and more aggressive behavior. And certainly this has been the case in China, where this system has grown very rapidly and some parts of it look extremely unhealthy. But to get to the bottom line, the reason why I'm not as concerned about this market as some would have you believe is simply because it's small. It is not yet big enough to subsume China. It has been growing very rapidly, but from a small base, and its aggregate size is at least as yet still manageable for China. There are some parts of it also that are not unhealthy. The whole system gets lumped together as if it's a fiasco, but there's some parts that are in deep trouble, but there's some parts that I think represent financial innovation that will ultimately be very positive for China's future, and we'll show you why in the ensuing pages of the presentation. The third row is the real estate sector, and for those of you who have been following China at all, you'll know that this has been a great source of concern. It's been the real estate sector has driven a lot of the Chinese economy's growth, but frankly, prices have risen very far, very rapidly, raising questions about affordability. Meanwhile, many apartments are said to be sitting vacant, And there's concern that there's too much borrowing going on to fuel all of this, and that it may create some sort of leverage-based crisis, not unlike what we experienced here in this country in 2008, 2009, 2010. What I'll tell you is that while I'm worried about all the things I just mentioned, ultimately, I don't think the solvency of the real estate sector is in great threat, not at least as yet, and particularly households look to be in fairly good shape. What I am worried about is that housing prices trend slowly lower over the next few years, and this really might undermine households' perception of their wealth, because frankly, households have way too much capital tied up in housing. And as their sense of wealth shrinks, I think that will hit their willingness to spend, and China's consumption may moderate or even decline. And if that happens, China's overall economy will lose perhaps its most important and most stable growth driver, and that will have follow-on effects for the speed of growth of the Chinese economy. And that gets me to the last row. By the way, we're going to present some more data on the real estate sector in a moment, so we'll go into this issue in some greater depth. But that gets me to the last row, the overall economic growth of the economy. And here I don't have good news. I think everything we see suggests that China is slowing further still. The consensus estimates for growth are around 7.3-7.4% right now. And that's based on Wall Street's economic forecasts. And frankly, I don't think there would be an economist out there forecasting growth that high if the government itself hadn't pledged that it would maintain growth at 7.5%. I really think everything I see points to a slowdown, and in particular, the real estate issue that I just mentioned may hit consumption and cause growth to slow further still. And China's traditional growth drivers, which are infrastructure investment, exports, and residential property construction, are all slowing and starting to reach limits in their own growth potential. So consequently, I think China may see growth go below 5% potentially over the next few years. But there is a silver lining, and that is that the current administration is engaged in one of the most aggressive reform efforts and most impressive reform efforts that I've seen in the last decade. And it leads me to be very hopeful about what China might look like 3 years hence. And I think there's a fairly strong possibility that if these reforms are well executed, China's growth may reaccelerate over 5%. It may get to be 6% or possibly even 7% once again in a few years' time. And that leads me to be somewhat more optimistic about the medium term. So that's the bottom line for the four major bricks in the wall. And we're going to go and examine a few of these bricks in greater detail. I wish we had enough time to spend on each of the four, but frankly, each one deserves a large essay or a small book. So we're going to try and present some data to discuss the second row, which is the shadow banking system, and the third row, which is the real estate sector, to give you a sense of why we think what we think in terms of the future. So if moving on to page 8, you'll see a representation of three different economic zones, China, the U.S., and the Eurozone in aggregate. And you'll see lines that depict the size of the shadow banking sectors relative to the broad stock of money in the society. It's a simple way of presenting how big an influence on allocating capital and credit these systems are relative to the overall scale of the money base. And what you'll see immediately is the size of the system in the U.S. dwarfs that of Europe, which in turn dwarfs that of China. Our own system grew very big and ultimately problematic, and frankly, it blew up on us in 2008, and you can see that blue line shrink since then, and that's the deleveraging that households and the financial sector has had to undertake since that time. China's black line at the bottom, meanwhile, has grown very rapidly. You can see there's been a steady uptrend in that line, but as yet, it still is not very big. Anytime credit growth expands so quickly, we all need to be worried about the health of underlying assets. But frankly, the size of the system is not yet big enough to present a worry. And in fact, I think it's a very important evolution in China's financial landscape, and I'll show you why on page 9. The historic reason for the evolution of the shadow banking system is really implied by the data presented here, where you'll see the traditional financial markets, the regulated channels for capital in the U.S. and in China. What you have is bank credit in the first column, the banking system effectively, stock market in the second column, bond markets in the third column, insurance markets in the fourth column, and asset management markets in the fifth column. The bubbles at the top show you the size of these various channels or conduits of capital in trillions of dollars. And the bars at the bottom show you how big these markets are relative to the local economies in percentage terms. And what you'll immediately see is the U.S. has big and very well-developed conduits of capital, and its banking system is really quite small. It actually has been disintermediated a long time ago by superior and more efficient forms of capital allocation, mainly the bond and equity markets. Meanwhile, China is extremely beholden to and dependent on its overlarge and overdeveloped state-owned and state-controlled banking system to the exclusion of these other forms of private market-driven capital allocation. It's really because the Communist Party wanted to have control over how capital was allocated in the society, and historically, at least, until the last few decades, it tended to stunt the growth of these other sectors. And this is very important, because I'll show you why on page 10. Because here we're going to examine those same conduits of capital, these same channels of capital, the banking sector. Now we're showing the shadow banking sector in the second column, the equity markets and the bond markets. But now we're going to show you where they steer the capital that they receive to. You can see the end demand sources, the end demanders of capital within these systems, households in blue, private entities in taupe or tan, state-owned enterprises in gray. State-owned enterprises are effectively companies controlled by, owned by, and controlled by the government. And local government financial vehicles in orange, which are very, very uniquely Chinese entities, but effectively there are quasi-private entities, but very closely associated with provincial and municipal governments. And so effectively they are tied to very closely to the government. And what you'll see that is in China, in these conduits of capital, the banking system is again by far the largest, and the vast majority of its capital is steered to either state-owned enterprises or local government financial vehicles. In other words, the banking system, which is state-owned and state-controlled, it mainly exists to serve the state. The blue bit, the household sector, has recently seen its exposure to mortgages grow, but this is a fairly new phenomenon. And the private market, the private sector, private corporations, barely get any loans from the banking system whatsoever. They're largely shut out. So most of the small and medium enterprises that are fueling China's growth are shut out of this system. Meanwhile, the equity market has been a new conduit of capital for the private sector alongside of state-owned enterprises, but this is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it's not very large as yet, and the bond markets have almost entirely shut out the private sector, favoring the state-owned enterprises, which are deemed to be government-related credits and therefore much safer than the state sector, than the private sector. So I want you to remember that China's economy is already $9.5 trillion and the U.S. economy is $15 trillion. Think about the size of our capital markets in relation to our own economy and how important they are in allocating capital to the most efficient sectors so as to drive our future growth. And remember that China's capital markets are small and stunted except for the overlarge state banking sector. And try and imagine the demand that's created from the private sector, which by most accounts is more than 55% of GDP in China. It's quite natural, therefore, that alternate forms of capital have sprung, or ultimate, conduits for capital have sprung up to serve that demand, and that's why the shadow banking sector has exploded in recent years as China has deregulated certain industries and made these conduits more free to act, I guess you could say. Not everything that has happened in this sector is by any stretch healthy. There's some segments within the shadow banking sector that look extremely dangerous to me. But I will also tell you there's some components of it that look like our corporate finance market, corporate paper market in the U.S., which is a form of short-term company-related financing that's generally considered fairly important and fairly healthy. So these alternate forms of capital allocation need to grow in China, and the banking sector ultimately needs to shrink. And I think this is important for China's future. I'm going to move on to page 11 and hand the presentation off to Kate to discuss the real estate sector.
Thanks, Andrew. The point of this table on page 11 here is that to illustrate how much housing stock exists, both sold and under construction, and how this housing stock is financed. As the table is titled, this data is for urban residential property, so it does not include rural housing trends, rural scrappage, or government policies in the countryside. The top row shows that a total of 8.5 billion square meters of residential housing stock has been purchased in China since 2000. This equates to roughly 440 square feet of residential housing for each urban Chinese household. We have a great deal of confidence that the data in this top row is accurate based on numerous sources, and what this row shows is that households enjoy a high degree of equity with their property portfolios, as much property is bought in cash. These households also enjoy manageable carrying costs with no property taxes and, in many cases, limited monthly dues. As current government policies are promoting mortgages to first-time homebuyers with as little as 20 to 30% down, leverage in this row could increase, but households are, I think, unlikely to experience insolvency even in a scenario of meaningful price declines due to the amount of equity backing this stock. The main risk here, and we can talk about this more later, is that declining prices will certainly impact consumption, which will drag on GDP. As Andrew mentioned earlier, households have over, it's estimated, 70% of their wealth tied up in property, and if prices fall, that will lead to negative effects on perception of wealth, which will certainly depress consumption. Before moving on to the second row, I want to be clear that I am only showing total residential stock sold since 2000 in urban areas, and as has been well publicized in the media, a not inconsiderable portion of the stock is unoccupied. But unoccupied or occupied, the leverage statistic remains the same in this top row. In the second row, in addition to the 8.5 billion square meters of residential stock that's been sold and is in the hands of households, there is another 4.9 billion meters square that is under construction by the formal development sector, namely listed and unlisted developers. This is another roughly 250 square feet under development for each urban household. What most people will find surprising about this row is that this sector, too, enjoys a high degree of equity in its holdings with a low 38% loan-to-value. But we will see in a moment that this amount of leverage on the sector's balance sheet may still induce pressure in a scenario of price and or sales volumes declines. Reiterating Andrew's comments earlier, this is an aggregate leverage statistic, and it masks the fact that there are some large players in this space that could come under a liquidity squeeze, needing to move a considerable amount of properties at lower prices with spillover effects for the entire industry. So this brings us to the third row, which is the most interesting one. It's the row where our research efforts bear the most fruit, presenting data that I haven't seen anywhere else. We're confident based on firsthand observations and also based on evidence within public statistics that a large stock of real estate is being developed by unofficial and largely untracked property developers. Specifically, I'm speaking of SOEs who are developing land next to their main businesses, local government financing vehicles engaged in residential property projects, and corporations outside the real estate sector who are dabbling in the property market. On the recent trip to mainland China that Andrew mentioned, we met with a couple of corporations who were seeking to augment their earnings with property development ventures. We've tried to represent the potential total gross floor space being developed by these entities here in this third row, as well as the likely sources of funding, much of which you can see in the lower right-hand corner is almost assuredly sourced in the shadow markets. I can't stress enough that the data in this row, especially in this final row, constitutes our estimates only, and we've made some assumptions to arrive at these numbers. We've presented high estimates for the debt this sector has likely incurred in order to develop these properties. We think it's on the order of magnitude correct, but as you can see here, the leverage statistic is very high and represents an aggregate estimate only. So while the leverage on a property project here in this sector is obviously reason for concern, it's important to consider that because this sector includes a large number of government-connected entities that will likely continue to have access to bank lines, one could argue that it is less likely that this sector will come under short-term liquidity strain. It's also worth pointing out that entities in this row likely have other non-property assets which offset this leverage. Still, given the leverage that likely exists in this third row, we might find these property projects most sensitive to price movements in the property market and prone to liquidate quickly if prices decline. Moving on to the next page, while the housing stock held by individuals looks okay and the developers don't appear to be overly leveraged, developers clearly need to continue to sell their inventory. What the top table on page 12 illustrates is that based on a weighted average interest rate of 8.4% and conservative net principal repayment assumptions, this formal development sector, the second row, must sell roughly 400 million square meters of gross floor space each year just in order to service their interest and pay the principal maturing. By way of comparison, 2013 residential sales totaled 1.2 billion square meters of GFA. So this 400 million square meters equates to roughly 35% of last year's total. Long way of saying that on the whole, developers need to continue to complete and monetize their units under construction. As an aside, residential property sales from these developers are 91% of 2013 levels. So volumes are down, but not staggeringly so. Another way to look at how much pressure the developers could come under is through different scenarios on price declines. What the second table illustrates is that if prices go down by 10%, developers would not have to sell 35% of last year's level, but closer to 40%, just in order to service their debt. If prices go down by 30%, developers would have to sell closer to 550 million square meters, or 50% of last year's volumes, just in order to service their debt. So basically, the second table, like the first one, underscores the need for developers to continue to move units. These are our findings on the housing stock and how it is funded in China. I'm most concerned that liquidity strains among developers, both the official and the unofficial, the second and third row, may prompt them to liquidate portions of their portfolio quickly, leading to price declines, which then impacts consumption. I will conclude by saying that as dire as some of these statistics may look, especially those in the third row, it's important to recognize in terms of the way structured and regulated, the Chinese property market and the Chinese financial system, for that matter, have scant little in common with property markets and financial systems in the developed world. Remember that the private property market only started in China in 1999, and I think most observers would agree that the Chinese government is keenly aware of the risks that are present today. More importantly, the government has a myriad of reform-based levers that it can pull as crises present themselves. For instance, with respect to the property market, slowly instating a property tax, introducing initiatives to expand the rental market, continuing with initiatives to promote first-time home ownership via mortgages, and the much-discussed hukou reform could have huge impacts on the housing market.
Thanks, Kate. I would just, again, summarize by saying we've worked hard to present this proprietary data. We had to pull together a number of estimates from a number of different sources. So do take everything we've just said with a grain of salt. But I think our takeaway from this is that there are undoubtedly going to be some extreme cases that blow up in headlines. But the household sector looks fairly healthy, and it's a very different scenario than what we saw here in this country in 2008. And so I think that means that the most important segment of the real estate sector is unlikely to experience severe pressure. But as Kate alluded to, it may hit consumption. And so I think if we think about China's future, what China's risking is an outcome more like Japan, where housing and real estate prices slowly deflated, and it was a huge drag on growth for the next two decades, but not the sort of sharp and, frankly, kind of cathartic crisis that the U.S. experienced in 2008. And so that's what we really have to be on guard for, is the more deflationary Japan-like outlook than a violent crisis. If we can move on to page 13, we've been talking about a wall of worry, and I tried to spell out the four obvious bricks in that wall, so to speak, but I want to talk about four other bricks in the wall that are less frequently or even sometimes not at all discussed, because I think this also goes to the gaps between perception and reality. Here we've tried to spell out four things that Seafarer is quite worried about that we don't see in the press or commonly discussed. There are four items. The first is a failure in the corporate payment system. I can tell you that corporate balance sheets are increasingly getting stretched, and if one of the corporations in this, one of the corporations in China has some sort of failure, it could create a string of defaults, as companies are very much dependent on each other in a way that they have not historically been. We'll show you some data on that in a moment. Second, I think that China's future will be marked by much higher currency volatility. I think in general the currency is in a very healthy position still and is unlikely to see the sort of extreme volatility that was associated with emerging market currencies earlier this year. But that said, China's currency is increasingly moving into more of an economic equilibrium, and ironically, I think that means more day-to-day volatility in the future and less of a managed stability that characterized the past, and that may have unknown consequences. Third, I would say that one thing that is rarely contemplated but could present a severe risk is the possibility that a large state-owned enterprise fails and the government does not move to bail it out. I don't know what would necessarily trigger that failure. It could be the decline in the real estate sector that we discussed earlier. It could be a failure in the corporate payment system, which we'll discuss in a moment, or perhaps some sort of currency exposure that's exacerbated as volatility in the currency rises. But if a large state-owned company fails, I think this will go to, and the government fails to bail it out, you could see a string of such failures unfold because it will really start to undermine the banking system's sense of solvency because so much of it is predicated on the state backing these entities. So I think that's something that is a low likelihood event, but we all need to be wary for it as the economic picture in China becomes cloudier. The fourth row is something that I think has been getting more attention as of late, but I want to stress it's going to be a permanent part of China's future, and that's the increasingly assertive posture China is adopting in its international and also its domestic affairs. Internationally, we've seen China move more aggressively in the South China Seas against Vietnam or against Japan in the Diaoyu Islands. So I think we have to get comfortable with a China that is at least more assertive about its international interests, hopefully not hostile. But also domestically, I think we saw signs while we were traveling there that China is moving more aggressively to protect its economic interests and possibly even shutting off conduits for trade. While we were traveling there, China was engaged in a minor tiff with the U.S. that was spilling over into a minor trade war regarding the importation of software and technological hardware from the U.S. in retaliation for some other events that the U.S. had brought to bear. So I think China is going to become more assertive, and that's not good for China in the long-term picture. But I think in the short term, it ironically might stimulate some domestic industries that suddenly receive protection from the state as trade linkages are perhaps curtailed. So I think these are four things that everyone should be paying attention to and that are not frequently discussed. The first of these is arguably the most worrisome to me because I don't see a clear resolution to it, and it's on page 14. As I mentioned, corporate payment systems in China are very stretched. When a company makes a sale to a customer, it delivers a product or service, but it doesn't always receive cash the same day. And when that happens, it records what's called a receivable. It's basically an IOU from the customer to the company, or put differently, the company is extending a little bit of credit to the customer in order to afford the purchase. What this chart shows you is the number of days that an average company takes to reclaim that cash that it's owed from its customer. And you can see a steady increase in this line. And what that means is that companies are taking longer and longer to collect their cash. It means it's placing greater and greater strain on their balance sheets as they effectively lend to their customers. And it means more and more strain on cash flow. And I am worried that if there is some sort of trigger event in the corporate system that causes a failure, and that there could be cascading failures that emanate out from that, and it's something that we all need to pay attention to because the payment system is growing increasingly taut. We see signs of it from the bottom up, and this data suggests from the top down that it really is happening. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the currency in greater depth and show you why I think there's greater volatility ahead, and that's visible on page 15. China's currency is still in a very solvent position, mainly because the government has accumulated such large foreign surpluses that it is recycled into holdings of foreign denominated assets that are shown by this light blue bar. China's trade exports have basically generated $4 trillion worth of foreign reserve assets. But the pace of that accumulation has slowed as China's exports have slowed in recent years. Meanwhile, the country is increasingly doing more borrowing from abroad in foreign currencies, which is represented by that blue bar, much smaller than the light blue bar, but is rising steadily. The net of these two things really determines the country's solvency at the margin, and we've netted these two things together in the dark blue line, and we have drawn the blue line relative to economic output in China to give you a sense of scale. The blue line was rising steadily through 2008 when China was accumulating ever larger foreign surpluses via its trade account, but as that has subsided and the country has borrowed more, the blue line is beginning to trend downward. This is a very healthy thing for the world and for China, frankly, because it means the currency is beginning to move into greater equilibrium, and China's great foreign surpluses are also beginning to move into greater equilibrium. But ironically, that means the currency may be more volatile in the future. And that's something we've been seeing as the Chinese themselves have grown more relaxed about letting two-way volatility in the currency occur. Page 16 is the silver lining to all of my and Kate's preceding comments, and it's really a very important reason to peer over the wall of worry and contemplate China's future. It is a list of the reforms that have been launched under the Xi administration, and I'll tell you frankly, this is the most sweeping and deepest set of reforms that I've seen launched in China in the last decade. And what's so impressive about this list is that it really is aimed at curing not just the symptoms of the problems we've just discussed, but actually targeting some of their root causes. Again, we don't have enough time to discuss everything on this list, but please take my word that almost everything here could be a game changer for China's economy, at least a bit of a game changer, and taken together, these certainly are a game changer for China's future. I think it's the sort of thing that could, if the majority of these reforms are successfully implemented, that China may be able to restore its growth rate and reinvigorate growth to something like 6% in the next 3 to 4 or 5 years. It will take some time for these reforms to unfold, and there'll be a great deal of volatility and uncertainty in the interim period, but I think it will unlock certain latent potential that exists within the Chinese economy, and it leaves me very hopeful for the future. What's the bottom line for the portfolio? I can't predict whether or not this list will be implemented successfully or well over the next few years. We'll be watching closely. But I think, given what I see taking place here, there's reason enough to stay invested in China. Let me give you an anecdote that explains why. The first item on the list is a mention of the reform drive that's been taking place in China. When this kicked off 2 years ago as the Xi administration came to power, most foreign observers saw the reform drive pretty skeptically. They thought it was mainly a tool for the Xi administration to consolidate power and vanquish its competitors, so to speak, within the government. But really, since that time, the depth and breadth of this anti-corruption drive has really extended to fairly impressive levels. But we saw something in a company visit that really surprised us. We visited a small cap company that has very low levels of foreign ownership. It's mainly a domestically oriented company, and it's heavily engaged in the provision of software and services to the transportation sector. Unfortunately, the transportation sector is often consumed by graft because so many of the tenders are conducted at provincial and municipal level, where there's a lot of rent-seeking behavior taking place in China. So we weren't surprised to see some of this behavior within the company's own financial statements. What we were surprised to see is that SASAC, S-A-S-A-C, China's most important watchdog agency, had recently made an investment in this company via a convertible bond. It didn't make sense to us because, frankly, the company didn't need the money that SASAC presented, and meanwhile, SASAC received extremely desirable terms on this bond. It was almost as if it was extracting something from the company. Meanwhile, SASAC received a board seat, even though it doesn't own any shares in this company as yet. I don't know what this investment really represents, but I can speculate. I think SASAC took a seat at this company because it gives it a bird's-eye view and even a detailed view of the kind of corruption and graft that's happening in the company in the transportation sector, and it realizes this company is a key cog in the machine. This isn't being done for foreign eyes or for foreign speculation or even domestic speculation so much. I think it speaks to the kind of reform effort that's underway, and I'm impressed. So to change gears, we're going to move on to the next segment of the presentation and discuss a cross-section of the CFAIR Fund, which begins on page 18. Here you'll see a very simple but I think powerful representation of the fund. Each one of these bubbles represents a holding in the fund, and its size represents its relative scale within the portfolio, its position weight, if you will. The x-axis represents the earnings per share growth estimated for that particular position over the next 2 years via consensus estimates. And the y-axis, the vertical axis, represents the trailing dividend yield available from that position. this represents everything we could plot on this chart, which means a few of the bonds have been thrown out, they don't have earnings per share growth, and a few of our positions are too small to be tracked by consensus estimates, and therefore there's no estimates available, and so we haven't plotted them here. But everything else is represented. The dashed blue line represents the linear regression fit for these bubbles. You could think of it as sort of an unweighted average representation of the portfolio's trade-offs between growth and yield. Meanwhile, the dark blue line represents the same sort of a linear regression fit for the MSCI Emerging Market Index, our main benchmark. I think these two blue lines are quite interesting to compare, and it's no surprise to me that the portfolio's line slopes downward a bit more steeply, suggesting we make a more careful trade-off between growth and yield, favoring higher yielding stocks than does the overall market. The intercept of our line is slightly higher. Meanwhile, our line got a steeper slope, suggesting that on average we have slightly slower growing stocks. We like to think we're finding more mature and steady growth versus speculating on some of the higher growth that is sometimes present in the overall emerging market index. But I was surprised when I plotted this to note that the slope of the lines and their intercept wasn't greatly different from one another until I realized what I've been doing as of late has influenced this, and I wanted to show you why. And that's on page 19. What I've done is highlight the four most recent additions to the portfolio in roughly the last 6 months or so. Those are highlighted in solid red. And the three most recent deletions from the portfolio are highlighted in dashed lines, and they're empty. I want you to exclude for the moment from my remarks the lower left red bubble, the one that's near the y-axis, and just concentrate on the other three and compare them to the three bubbles that we deleted. And what you'll notice immediately is that those positions unambiguously, that cluster unambiguously offers higher growth than the three positions that we deleted. And this has been a very deliberate tactic that I have implemented at the margin within the portfolio. We're not revolving the whole portfolio around, but we have been tactically weighting the portfolio towards higher growth names. And it's simply because the market as a whole has been, frankly, concerned about growth over the last 2 years. And frankly, the market has begun paying more for dividend-yielding stocks and less for growth. In other words, the slope of the market line has begun to look more like our own. And so at the margin, I'm acting counter to that a bit because I think growth is at the margin a little less well-valued than it should be. And so therefore, the addition of these names. So you may say, all fine and good, Andrew, you've picked up some slightly higher growing names, maybe a little less yield as a consequence, but what of this position at the lower left you told us to ignore? Well, you may be surprised to see what it is on page 20. It's Samsung Electronics. We've bought the preferred share relatively recently. Samsung Electronics is the biggest singles constituent within the emerging market index, and historically, it's a technology company. Most of you know it. It provides all sorts of consumer electronics, cell phones, television sets, etc., very high-end stuff, and it competes directly with Apple. And historically, this has been a very high-growth company. But more recently, analyst forecasts have begun to suggest that it would grow actually -1% compounded over the next 2 years. We don't agree with those forecasts. We estimate that the company will grow considerably faster, not much faster, but well within positive territory. And meanwhile, its meager dividend yield we think is about to change for the better in the future. Samsung, maybe broadly like Apple, is sitting on huge stores of cash on its balance sheet, and meanwhile, it's going under a change of control as the father that owns the company begins to pass his ownership and control to the son, and we think that process will begin to unlock value from both the balance sheet and from the cash flow stream the company generates. And consequently, we expect a higher dividend yield in the future. So we think this position, while in the lower left and perhaps not seemingly adding much to the portfolio, will do quite a bit better than the consensus estimates or the trailing yield suggest. So you may say, well, okay, fine, Samsung Electronics, I understand that. But what about these two bubbles right next to it, these smaller ones that are hovering around zero growth without much yield? What are those? It may surprise you to know that those are two of the three best performing positions for the fund across its entire history. What's happened is that the stock's prices have risen dramatically, vastly outstripping the original dividend yields and the growth in dividend. They have experienced positive dividend growth, but nothing like the share price growth, and therefore the yield has become compressed over time. Meanwhile, the earnings per share growth outpaced analysts' estimates and kind of caught analysts by surprise, but they have not yet refigured consensus estimates that are anything higher. Analysts are basically somewhat doubting that the recent earnings momentum can be sustained. And therefore, you see low growth and low yield. We have continued to hold these names because we think they're excellent names for the long run, but you can see the position size has shrunk a great deal, and that's me basically taking risk off the table. We've had these positions outperform mightily. We think they're good holdings for the long run, but we wanted to shrink them back a bit because of valuation, more shorter-term valuation-related concerns. So that may be fine and well as also, but let's talk about that furthermost left bubble, the one that's basically touching the dashed line. Why would we want to own a position like this? Certainly, it's got a fairly high yield, what looks to be generally above average, but its earnings growth is obviously very negative. It's forecast to grow at minus 14% each of the next 2 years at least on a smooth annualized basis. What you'll see that position on page 21. It's called PGE, and it may surprise you to note that this company is one of our best performers year to date. It's an electrical utility based in Warsaw. It's Poland's biggest utility, and it's the dominant one in Warsaw. And what's happened is its share price has performed well as analysts have been caught again by surprise that earnings growth vastly outstripped their expectations for 2013. Almost no matter when you picked up the consensus estimates for this stock last year, you would have seen between minus 15 and 20% growth. The actual net profit growth was closer to 13% positive. There are a few one-off factors in that earnings growth, but the single biggest driver of that earnings growth was that the fact that the company cut costs in a way that analysts failed to perceive. This is a state-owned enterprise, and it has historically been big, bloated, and to some extent inefficient. A lot of analysts will tell you to stay away from these sort of companies because they see them as beyond reform. But I'll tell you, one of the things we do at CFIR is exploit that kind of perception and try and look for the kinds of companies that are becoming more commercial, more efficient in their orientation, and who can outpace expectations. You can see the core of the strategy on page 22, which is delineated by the dashed circle. It's really our prime hunting ground. These are stocks that have above average yields that are above the risk-free rate in their local markets and above the 10-year U.S. Treasury, and also whose growth is maybe slower than the market as a whole, but we think fairly stable. And it's no surprise, therefore, that our single biggest holding, Singapore Telecom, lies on the boundaries of this circle. Singapore Telecom is scheduled to grow at 6% compounded over the next 2 years on an earnings per share basis. We think it'll do a slightly better than that because of translation of currency-related gains. But even so, it's a steady grower on the boundaries of the circle, and it has well above average yields that we think it can sustain. So it would make sense it's within our sort of – our biggest holding is within the sort of core hunting ground of the strategy, if you will. But I want you to note the dispersion that exists in the portfolio around this circle. It really highlights the fact that we cast our net wide. We're trying to build an all-weather portfolio, and we're willing to make trade-offs between growth and yield that are represented by the dots in this circle that lie outside of that red boundary line. And what we're really trying to do is hopefully outsmart the market in perception of its earnings growth or in terms of a company's ability to grow its yield over time. Page 23 shows a little bit of our success rate so far, and it's something I'm very proud of. What we're doing is comparing the fund versus the index. The fund is on the left, the index is on the right. And what these two pie charts show you is the number of holdings in each and how they've contributed to performance. Dark blue represents the number of holdings since inception within the fund that have caused the fund to post a gain. And the white slices represent positions that have had neutral effect, and the light blue negative effect. And what you can see is the fund has had a fairly high hit rate. 62 of the 82 positions that we've held since inception have contributed positively to performance. That's what you might call a 76 20% hit rate. And frankly, that's better than my long-term batting average or what I would really aspire to. So I'm very happy and proud of the work we've done, and I hope that we can continue to do such work even as we've been outpacing my own expectation in the short run. You can see a little bit more color around that concept on page 24, which gives you a distribution of the positions in the portfolio since its inception. Each of the positions are bucketed within certain brackets visible at the bottom of the table, and basically you can see how much they've been contributing and how many big winners we've had, how many little winners, and how many big losses we've had within the portfolio since we launched it. The dark blue portion of the bars represents the positions we still hold. That's 47 positions in total. And the light blue represents the number of positions we've sold. That's 35 positions in total. And what I'm proud to again present here is the positive skew in this chart. Not only do we have more big winners on the far right than we do big losers, but also we have had a fairly positive skew right around the middle, where you see a number of positions that have had smaller aggregate impact on the portfolio, but definitely outweighing those with a negative impact. And it's that positive skew that I think has driven the fund's performance to date. I want to reflect quickly on the light blue, which, frankly, we've sold 35 positions since we've launched. I will tell you quickly that about six of those positions are more frictional, or, frankly, they're positions that came to a natural conclusion or their natural fruition, so they were less to do with deliberate portfolio construction decisions. But if we net those out, I have sold 29 positions since we've launched. And that's, frankly, a bit higher turnover than I would normally espouse to. I like to hold positions at least in excess of 3 years and typically more like five or six, or possibly forever. And so this higher turnover is really a reflection of the environment that the fund has been in. We discussed at the beginning of the call that there's been quite a bit of extreme volatility, and that's led us to reposition the portfolio. And I don't think that's going away anytime soon. As we've discussed with respect to China, China is going through a major economic inflection point, and I expect we'll see more price noise and more volatility in markets in the next few years ahead. And that will probably lead us to make greater shifts within the portfolio as we try to capture the opportunities that this inflection point presents. So with all this in mind, we again want to thank you for your time on this call. We're going to move to the question and answer section now, and we recognize that some of you will have to drop off due to your own time constraints. But for those of you that can stay on, I would like to introduce Michelle, who will host our question and answer session. Michelle.
Thank you, Andrew. As we get the Q&A underway, if you wish to submit a question, please go to seafarerfunds.com, where you will see a submit a question link on the homepage. So our first question concerns Vietnam. Andrew, what are your thoughts on valuations in Vietnam and opportunities for the portfolio? Also, can you give us an update on the country's banking system?
Yeah, to address the last question first, Vietnam is currently engaged in cleaning up the very high component of its non-performing assets in its banking system. I just read an estimate that it's as high as 9%, which is frankly a worrisome level. What I can say that's positive about that is that Vietnam has constructed a very clever approach towards cleaning up those assets, one of the simplest, most straightforward, and I think best approaches that I've ever seen in the developing world. They seem to have incorporated a lot of lessons learned from other experiences in other countries in the past. The only problem therein is that perhaps Vietnam is not moving quickly enough to carve out the bad assets from the bank's balance sheets and clean them up. And that's the approach they've taken is basically to split the good portions of the banks away from the bad portions, which is generally a tried and true method. I think that as long as Vietnam keeps up the pace of this asset cleanup, it will be in better position in the future. In the meantime, the economy is still growing in excess of 5%. I think valuations in the country are quite attractive. We still have a position there in excess of about 6%. We have been experiencing a great deal of outperformance in that market year to date, but frankly, in May, it was a setback for the portfolio because a lot of the headlines around China's conflicts with Vietnam and the South China Seas really put a great deal of pressure on the market, and we saw almost all of our outperformance in Vietnam lost in the span of a few weeks. So that's been frustrating for me, but I don't think it outweighs the underlying fundamentals in this market, at least not as yet. And I'm excited to remain invested there, and I think the valuations warrant it.
Thank you, Andrew. The next question is focused on China. The Chinese stock market has not participated very much in the post-2008-2009 rally. Do you think this leaves Chinese stocks undervalued versus most of the developed world? And if so, what needs to happen to get the Chinese market moving again?
Yeah, I think if you look at a broad market index for China, its current price-to-earnings ratio is about 10, and its price-to-book ratio is about 1.4. That means it's some moderately cheaper than the overall emerging market index right now, but not dramatically so. And I think, as the questioner asks, or implies quite correctly, China has really failed to participate in a lot of the post-2008 rally. It did well immediately in 2009 and to a lesser extent in 2010, but markets have been trending sideways and downwards just about ever since. And really, it's for the reasons that we discussed earlier on the call. There are major bricks in the wall of worry, and basically China's growth model, or at least its historic growth model, is coming to an end. And unless China undertakes the sort of reforms that I discussed on page 16 of the presentation, or unless China starts to cure some of or address some of the bricks in the wall that we discussed, I think China's growth prospects will slowly wither, and the market is quite accurately pricing this in. But what I think the market has failed to really appreciate is how swiftly and aggressively China will move to reform itself if it has the political will to do so. In the past, at least, China has never been rich enough, frankly, to ignore the imperative for reform if its economy was off track. And its economy, admittedly, China has accumulated a great deal more wealth and more economic clout than it has done in the past. And to some extent, it insulates it from reform, the pressure for reform. But I don't think we have a Japan-like scenario where the country may go into two decades of malaise. I think I see the political will forming behind the reform list that I presented earlier, that I'm becoming increasingly confident China will execute, and it will mean that the country will tap into some of the latent potential that exists within its economy, and I think the growth will resume. And therefore, on the medium-term basis, I think the market is looking increasingly attractive, but it's very murky what might happen over the next couple of years.
Thanks, Andrew. The next question addresses the sovereign bonds that CFAIR has introduced into the fund's portfolio this year. Are these bonds local currency denominated? And if so, how do you view the currency risk associated with these holdings?
Yes, we've introduced three bonds, a Brazilian sovereign, a Turkey sovereign, and an Indonesian sovereign, each about a percent and a third. So collectively, they're 4% of the total. We did so really because we thought markets were getting extremely distressed in January. We added these positions late January, early February. The bond markets were really being beaten up terribly, as were the currency markets at that point. We had some extra cash on hand, not much, but we had some extra cash on hand that we were mainly using as a liquidity buffer within the portfolio. In other words, it's money that I wanted to put to work, but frankly, I wanted to hold the need to preserve a certain amount of liquidity in the portfolio outweighed the desire to put it to work. And so what I saw was an opportunity to buy some very high-yielding bonds with very high coupons from some admittedly risky sovereigns within the emerging world. At the time we purchased these bonds, they had between 9 and 10% yields associated with them. And I grew comfortable with this idea, with the associated currency risk that the fund might take up. We began to model different scenarios and realized that even if these currencies have a great deal of volatility over the intervening years until these bonds mature, and by the way, their maturities are quite long, with yields this high, we can withstand a lot of interim currency volatility. It will ultimately detract from our yield, but we imagine that our net yield, or put differently, the yield less the currency loss over time, will be quite substantially positive and much better than the cash that we were originally holding. Meanwhile, When we look at the trade-offs between cash and these bonds in terms of liquidity, we see almost no deterioration. Even when these bonds were at their most stressed, they were shockingly liquid, and importantly, they were differently liquid than the equities in our portfolio. They provided a different and alternate source of liquidity, which I really like to preserve and accumulate in the fund. It's valuable to the fund to have a position that trades in a different time zone, that trades with a different set of end investors, that trades when maybe most of our equity markets are on holiday. The Turkish bond is a good example of that. That is by no means a particularly liquid sovereign bond, but it is very differently liquid than the equities that I hold in the portfolio otherwise. When China's on holiday, when Indonesia's on holiday, Turkey's often open in trading, and that bond represents a small incremental dose of liquidity to the portfolio that I would not otherwise experience. So I think that was the attraction to these positions, and we're excited to have them. I don't think that this is going to represent a big portion of the portfolio. I imagine it will stay relatively contained in the future, because if it grew much larger, it would represent a source of currency risk that I'm not comfortable with taking on.
Thanks, Andrew. Let's take one more question, and then we will conclude the call today. Andrew, what is your currency hedging policy for the portfolio?
Yes, I don't engage in derivative-based hedging at this time. We've left some room in the prospectus to do so at some point way down the road if we develop the models that we think could help us in this regard. But frankly, my historical experience tells me it's too costly to do, it's too hard to do, and you're frankly best off avoiding markets altogether where you think there are real currency risks that might manifest themselves. It's actually been my experience that currencies are very important to pay attention to, because they are often the ultimate pressure point or pressure valve where the macroeconomic sins of a country are released. So frankly, if you're a bottom-up investor, you need to pay attention to two things: your companies and the currency in which they operate. And so we have begun to measure and model the risks associated with currencies that in which we invest more carefully, and we have developed some risk management tools that lead us to be less exposed to some currencies that we're more concerned about and more exposed to some currencies that we are less concerned about. But I want to stress, there is no such thing as a safe emerging market currency. These are all relative shades of gray. So when we say that there's some currencies we're less concerned about, we acknowledge and accept that these currencies are likely to be volatile and maybe even downward trading over the longer term versus the U.S. dollar. But these are risks that we're willing to accept on a relative basis in the context of our long-only equity portfolio. We think that the stocks we're buying, their price gains will outweigh that currency risk over time and with diversification.
Thanks, Andrew. With that final comment, we are going to wrap up our discussion today. We want to thank everyone for participating on the call. We look forward to having future conversations with you. And if you should have any questions about CFAIR or today's presentation, please email us at contact@cfairfunds.com.
Thanks, everyone, for participating, and thank you for entrusting us with your capital, and we look forward to you joining us on our next call.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.